From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a new podcast tells the story of two prime figures in elite gymnastics who enabled Larry Nassar's abuse of hundreds of young women. It all happened at the Texas ranch owned by Bela and Marta Caroli.
You know, they probably chose that location because it's very isolated, because they could pretty much do whatever they wanted and have the most control over the athletes.
Young women who trained there underwent brutal physical conditions, psychological conditioning, and abuse out of parental reach. We'll hear their story. Also, one producer hearing intergenerational conversations hears important exchanges.
Then I decided, oh, what if it contained one discrete piece of advice? Rather than these sprawling conversations that I really like to listen to, I just kind of wanted to sculpt something a little more minimal.
The Best Advice Show, coming up on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the program, you need some advice about your relationships, your career goals, or just simple things like what to cook for dinner? The creator of a new podcast called The Best Advice Show wants you to know you are not alone.
I love those types of things, like these little things that people do just to enrich their lives that, like, you don't need a lot of money for.
That's coming up later in the hour. But first, women's gymnastics has been under deep scrutiny in recent years. You've learned a lot about the former team doctor Larry Nassar story and his victims through the Michigan radio podcast Believed. But a lot of people still have unanswered questions about how things went so deeply wrong at the sport's governing body over the past two decades. ESPN's 30 for 30 podcast unit has produced a new series that tracks down some answers. You probably know the Romanian-born coach Bela Caroli was a dominant figure in USA gymnastics circles. If you don't follow the sport, you might be less familiar with the role Caroli's wife Marta played. She presided over operations at the Caroli Ranch. The new series is Heavy Metals, Inside the Caroli Gymnastics Empire, and it takes us there. Let's have a listen.
It reminded Scott of covering the NFL, standing on the sidelines and hearing the bone-crushing impact of big tackles.
It's the same gut punch to you, like, wow. I mean, that's something.
And it had similar consequences. Scott found that national team gymnasts had surgery at the same rate as those NFL players. He presented his data to USA Gymnastics and Marta Caroli.
So Marta says, when we saw there was an injury, we got the gymnast to the right person right away. Well, that right person was Larry Nassar.
One of the gymnasts featured in Heavy Metals is Jordan Weber. She's head coach at the Arkansas Razorbacks gymnastics team. In 2012, she was one of the Fierce Five who brought home a gold medal for team competition at the Summer Olympics in London. She's also one of the hundreds of women who took part in USA Gymnastics and who have since come forward to talk about abuse in the program and sexual abuse by the former team doctor Larry Nassar. Jordan Weber, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Rita Weber is here, also Jordan's mom. She is a nurse at Sparrow Health. Rita Weber, it's good to hear your voice. Thanks for being with us.
Well, and thanks for having me as well.
I wanted to start by going back a little bit and ask if either of you remember a point at which you realized that, Jordan, your talent was going to be something that could draw you into the elite levels of competition, something you wanted to really devote your young life to.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, my mom can probably answer this question better than I can because I was pretty young. I started gymnastics at four. I just remember everything kind of moving so quickly. By the time I was seven, I was competing for the first time. And then 3 years later at 10, I was vying for a spot on the national team. So, you know, that's a lot younger than most other gymnasts. I kind of progressed really quickly. And I think just the speed of all of that made me realize, okay, this might be something that I'm pretty good at. And so then, you know, I remember watching the Olympics for the first time on TV in 2004, watching Carly Patterson. And that's really when I set my sights on my Olympic dream. And at that time, I was just kind of emerging in gymnastics. And I thought, okay, you know what? That's my goal. I'm going to work every day towards that goal. So it was kind of around, I would say 9 or 10 that I really kind of realized that might be something that's possible for me in the sport.
Yeah. Rita, what are your memories of that time?
Well, Jordan's correct. It was a very fast process because she did progress quickly through the JO or the Junior Olympic levels, probably when she was about 8 years old, her coach started talking to us about pursuing elite gymnastics. And, you know, at the time, I really had no idea what that even meant. Didn't know anybody else who had a child in this level of gymnastics. And I think it was probably about age 9 or early 10 years old when she started doing very well at the upper levels of the JO. And I thought, okay, she's either going to stay at level 10 for the next 7 years, which seems like she'd be completely bored and wouldn't work, or she's going to have to pursue elite gymnastics. So that's what Jordan wanted, and we went from there.
What did the invite to the Caroli Ranch mean at that point?
Well, at that time, I kind of knew about the ranch because I had been there a couple times for what's called TOPS testing, and that was more like a fun camp that we got to go to. But when I was 9, I was first invited to the ranch for a national team camp. At that time, it was like, oh my gosh, this is such an honor. You kind of knew that if you were invited to the ranch, then you were being looked at, you were being watched from the national team staff. And, you know, that was one of the things that was going to take me one step closer to, you know, succeeding at the elite level and hopefully one day making an Olympic team. So I remember feeling like it was really cool. It was such an honor to be there. And then when I got there, I just kind of looked around and saw all of these older Olympians like Nastia Liukin, Sean Johnson, Alicia Sacramone, just all of these amazing role models of mine. And I just thought, wow, I can't believe that I get to be here. And then, you know, long story short, I ended up going once a month for about 6 or 7 years. It kind of started out as this amazing honor and ended up as this, you know, kind of stressful experience, really intense practices that we had. But at the beginning, it was really, I just felt honored to be there.
Rita, what was your impression of the ranch the first time you went?
Well, I remember the first time I went to the ranch, which I think was the only time I went because parents weren't allowed there. And I can't remember if it was for the TOPS testing when she made the A team, when they were invited there to a week of camp for, you know, achieving this status, or if it was, it had to have been then because we were never invited when she went just as part of training for the national team. But they had a meeting for the parents. And I remember sitting in this room of parents, and it's probably the first time it really hit me that, wow, my daughter must be really good because I'm sitting here at this Caroli Ranch where all these famous Olympians have come through and you have to be handpicked and invited to be here. On the other hand, it was very overwhelming because when they described the different paths and tracks that you could take in the elite world of gymnastics, it was scary because I had no idea if I was going to be making the right decisions for my daughter, listening to them and all of the intensities that were going to be part of this. I just didn't know if that was something I should let her do or push her to do or encourage her to do. And I just felt very scared at that point, a little bit overwhelmed. But then again, also felt this weird sense of like, wow, this is a huge honor. And maybe I should just be happy that I'm here because not every gymnast is here.
Yeah.
It was a mixed bag of emotions of, you know, being a little bit overwhelmed, scared, and then on the other hand, feeling excited.
You know, Allie Reisman told the Washington Post about conditions at the ranch. And based on what's in the podcast and what Allie has said about it, it sounds like there weren't a lot of opportunities for parents to make decisions. That conditions at the ranch, first of all, were pretty appalling. Prison-grade meals, no bottled water, no medical facility to speak of, and also just a really controlling atmosphere. Was any of that visually apparent from a first visit to the place?
For me as a parent, we were given a tour of the facility. It seemed to me kind of like what I remember is like a Girl Scout camp being or something like that. It was very rustic. We just got a quick peek into the eating area. I remember seeing Bella Caroli in the laundry room doing laundry. There were wild animals out in the property. There was a big pool that wasn't in working condition, but I thought, oh, this seems fun. They kind of presented it as like this camp environment, like you would envision going to some kind of a Girl Scout camp or a family camp or something.
Right.
So you didn't really get the perception that it was going to be, you know, as restrictive as it was. We were never informed or even, I didn't even really think to ask like, who's going to be watching them? Are there going to be medical facilities nearby? I didn't even think about any of that. I was just really just so excited that we were there and she was being asked to be part of this. It's kind of like you get swooped up into it so fast and you just feel like if you say anything or ask any questions, you might get moved from one list to another list and ruin some opportunity for your daughter. So none of those questions even really were in my mind at the time.
Well, and we got to say, I mean, Jordan, weren't you about 11 when this was happening?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first time I ever went, I was 9. And then by the time I was 11, I was going once a month. And I think my mom's exactly right. At first glance, it just looks like, you know, a summer camp. You know, you walk in the rooms, it doesn't seem like anything is really that bad. And then after going there so many times, it was like the first time we turned the showers on, every room smelled like rotten eggs. And the food, you know, it made our stomachs hurt. It didn't sit well. It was just, you know, we didn't have a great experience there because it wasn't a pleasant place to stay and to live. And a lot of bugs, we would find cockroaches in our rooms, things like that. It just, you know, at the time it was just kind of annoying or, you know, gross to us. But looking back, it's like, you know, being so young and without having your parents there and without a ton of, you know, parental supervision and all that, it's not great conditions for elite level athletes who are representing the USA in other countries, you know, to stay in. I think, you know, I have a lot more perspective now as an adult, you know, the conditions, it wasn't great.
What kind of figures were Marta and Bela Karoly during that time?
You know, at that time, I remember thinking they were these basically gymnastics gods. They were kind of legends in the world of gymnastics. I know they had, at that time, I knew they had coached Olympians. I knew they had coached Nadia Comaneci, and they were kind of the leaders of this system that was USA Gymnastics. And as a young person, you really feel like under that national team system and under Marta and Bela Karoly, at my time, you know, Bela wasn't super involved. It was really just Marta as the national team coordinator. But really, it was like if you were noticed by them, you might make it in the world of elite gymnastics. So I remember just feeling like they were these gymnastics gods, but also just very, very intimidating, especially Marta, because she was the one I spent the most time around. If she walked in the room, I mean, everybody just kind of perked up and didn't say anything and just kind of waited to see how she was going to act. And I would just say the best word to describe her was just really intense and intimidating.
After the break, we continue our conversation with Jordan and Rita Weber. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's continue our conversation with Olympic gymnast and current coach of the Arkansas Razorbacks college gymnastics team, Jordan Weber. We're also speaking with her mother, Rita. We were discussing Jordan's time at the Karoly Ranch in Texas. It's at the center of a new ESPN 30 for 30 podcast series called Heavy Metals. Rita, given the controlling atmosphere at the ranch, what kind of role did Larry Nassar end up playing in terms of communicating with parents?
You know, ironically, I remember the times that I knew Larry was going to camp when Jordan was going to be there, I would feel relieved that there would be somebody there that would maybe communicate with me, that would kind of give me the back story on what went down at camp, because I always felt a little bit nervous to ask Jordan's coach how things went. Didn't always provide any information to me. I couldn't call Jordan at all. I had no method of communicating with her. I just had to wait for her to be able to call me. So when Larry was there, I always thought, oh, good. I know Larry will keep me in the loop. I know Larry will keep Jordan safe. He'll keep an eye on her, because I thought, you know, I had this perception after Jordan went a few times that the coaches just all kind of got together in the evenings and had wine and did their own thing. And so I just was glad to know that there was somebody that I knew personally that was a friend of mine that could keep an eye on Jordan. Looking back now, it's very ironic that that's what I felt about Larry at the time.
Yeah. And Jordan, you took a pretty severe injury during your time at the ranch, I think when you were a little bit older. Would you mind telling us that story about what happened to you and how it was attended to?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, you know, I don't remember it too well, but I do remember some kind of key things. I remember spraining my ankle pretty bad at camp. I was supposed to go on from camp directly to an international competition and compete, but I landed a vault really short and sprained my ankle pretty severely. And I remember getting in the car and going to the hospital, which, you know, was pretty far away from the ranch. It was, I want to say it was like an hour away just to get to the hospital. And I went to the hospital and they, you know, x-rayed me and treated my ankle and all of that. And then I was taken back to the ranch. And, you know, looking back now and after actually listening to the podcast, I realized just the way that that was taken care of and the lack of communication with my parents and all of that was just so bad. And I didn't even really know it at the time. But it is scary being in a place that's so isolated and getting hurt. And at the time, you know, I felt like an adult because I was experiencing some pretty adult like things, but I was just a kid and I was injured and I, you know, wanted my parents around, but they weren't allowed to be there. And not only that, but it was really difficult to call my parents while I was there. There was so little cell phone service. I had to basically stand out in the middle of the field in order to get my cell phone out and call my mom. So going through an injury in a place like that is really scary. And now, you know, after hearing my mom's side of it, it was just, I can imagine even more scary for her because she was never called. She was never informed that I was hurt and taken to the hospital, which is, you know, not very good at all.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just funny. I think a lot of people find it hard to understand what the physical experience of elite gymnastics is like. And what you just said about having to think back to which injury, you know, which injury it was, really says a lot about that. Are there ways in which the community at the ranch kind of normalized that lack of attention to potentially very serious physical problems?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, the training was so intense. I mean, every move you make, every skill you do, all eyes are on you. So not only are you doing sort of the normal training that we usually do when we're at home at our gyms, but the anxiety and the stress is so much higher that naturally your body and your mind gets way more tired over the course of those 5 days. But, you know, the other part of that is, you know, when you're practicing at the ranch and Marta is watching, it's like, that's your shot. And if you mess up under that pressure, it's very likely that she'll just kind of look the other way and forget about you. And so, you know, when it comes to injuries and if you have a little ache or a pain, I would say, you know, it was really normalized for either coaches or athletes to just kind of pretend like it wasn't there because you didn't want to lose your shot. You didn't want to lose your opportunity to impress Marta and, you know, stay on your path towards your goals of going to Olympics. So it's definitely crazy. I feel like a lot of injuries were pushed through that shouldn't have been pushed through. And the gymnastics and the competitions were definitely the priority over the health and the safety and even the mental health of the athletes there.
Jordan, you're a coach yourself now. Do you see that kind of attitude toward physical injury is being necessary to get people to compete at a certain level?
Absolutely not. It's interesting having the perspective that I have in my own gymnastics career and then now being a coach. There's so many things that I do differently. My first and foremost priority with my student athletes is their mental and physical health and safety. And I prioritize that over anything, over any win, over any competition. And I find that that actually produces better results and healthier athletes and happier athletes in the long run, which is, I wish that's the attitude that, you know, the national team had. I think, you know, elite gymnastics can take a note out of college gymnastics' book, because I feel like that's something that college programs do really, really well is they really pay attention to the mental, physical health of the student athletes. And, you know, now, especially because of my experience, I try to be the most fierce advocate for my student athletes I can possibly be, because I don't ever want them to go through an experience like we did at the ranch or in the elite gymnastics world.
Rita, I wanted to ask when it was that you first heard that Larry Nassar was abusing girls in the program.
You know, it's funny that you asked that, because I have to really stretch my mind to try to remember when I first started hearing hints of this. And I think I remember Jordan telling me that there was some, or it might've been my other daughter, Lindsay, telling me that there was some scuttle going on about some things that Larry did with USAG and that he was going to be stepping down from his position at USA Gymnastics. And this was after Jordan's career. So I wasn't really, you know, that concerned about it. I'm like, oh, really? I mean, I wonder what it is. I didn't have any idea it was something of sexual abuse in nature. So I heard some mumblings and just kind of thought, oh, it must be, you know, something that he didn't really do. And then when I heard the specifics, my first instinct was, well, that can't be true. Not Larry. He's, you know, he's this amazing physician. He's an amazing father. He has an autistic foundation. He goes to church. He teaches Sunday school. I mean, he's, you know, in that package of just like the, you know, not somebody you would ever believe would have the capability of doing what he did. But then I remember specifically hearing probably, you know, a few weeks after things started coming out that he was doing this with ungloved hands. And just being in the medical field, I knew right away, there's no reason anybody would ever do that. What he was doing with ungloved hands, unless it was for a different purpose. And so at that moment, I knew my stomach just sunk and I knew that there was something real going on. Of course, I had no idea how many survivors there would end up being, but it was devastating to say the least.
I want to ask both of you how the environment at the Caroli Ranch made it possible for Larry Nassar to do what he did.
Well, I mean, for starters, the location where the ranch was, it was out in the middle of the woods somewhere in Houston. I mean, we had to drive about an hour and a half from the airport to get there. So, you know, the ranch in and of itself was very isolated. I think, you know, again, now that I'm an adult and I kind of see the 360 view of all of this, I think that was purposeful. I think that, you know, they probably chose that location because it's very isolated, because they could pretty much do whatever they wanted there and have the most control over the athletes. And, you know, we couldn't just go out and go to the store and buy snacks. We couldn't just, you know, go into town and, you know, use a phone or anything like that. So I think that was purposeful. And I think, you know, the fact that parents weren't allowed was another purposeful tactic, you know, and, you know, there wasn't a lot of supervision. It was just intense. It was 5 days of just hard mental and physical training. So I think the fact that it was so isolated, there wasn't a lot of supervision. I think all of that was intentional and made it possible for, you know, the USA Gymnastics to create this environment of control, and you know, everything was able to be kept quiet, and athletes didn't feel like they were able to say anything or have a say in anything that was going on there. So this culture of silencing and just kind of a military style, you come in, you do your work, you put your head down, you don't say much, you're obedient. That culture was really allowed to thrive in the environment that was the ranch.
How about you, Rita? What would you have to say about that? As a parent, were there ways in which the, you know, the culture of the ranch and all of the silence and all of the, you know, the feeling of that, you know, your actions might affect your kid's future in the sport, you know, may have kept people from asking questions that they might have otherwise?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember thinking after a while, I just felt so proud and honored that Jordan was part of this, you know, potential Olympic program and that she was at this elite level. And I remember kind of like feeling, you know, bragging almost that she went to the ranch every month, that she was selected, that she was special. And I was always told that, you know, the reason parents aren't allowed is because they want the athletes to focus on their gymnastics. They don't want any parents getting into their head, and you know, they don't want them to be looking to their parents for help or support. They need to be able to handle things on their own. They need to be going to their coach for problems, not their parents. And I always just accepted that is why it was that way. Hearing Jordan explain it and now looking back, I'm thinking, I can't believe I never even thought that this wasn't right. But it's such a fine line between speaking up and asking questions and feeling like you could end up ruining your daughter's potential career just because you are speaking up. And we know what happened with, you know, Maggie Nichols, for example, when she spoke up.
Yeah, she said that she felt abused by USA Gymnastics after she reported abuse by Larry Nassar. She was
exactly
sidelined from Olympic competition.
Right.
Jordan, did you experience anything like that yourself?
Not quite to the extent that Maggie did. I feel like I was one of the lucky ones in terms of, you know, at least at the beginning, for how I was treated by USA Gymnastics, because I was doing well and because I was excelling. But I will say I did experience something like that after the Olympics was over. You know, I was expected, I was the reigning world champion. I was expected to go in and vie for that all around medal at the Olympics. And at that time I had a stress fracture in my shin and wasn't really competing or training to my full potential because of the injury that I had. And, you know, I feel like as a result, that's one of the big reasons why I didn't qualify to the all around competition. And I remember, a specific instance where after the Olympics, we had gone to New York, we were doing a bunch of TV appearances. And because I had a broken leg, I was wearing a boot on my foot that protected my leg. And the president of USA Gymnastics had gone up to us, and my mom was standing there and I was standing there, and he said, we were about to go on the David Letterman show. And he said, get that boot off of her foot. And at that time, you know, you think about that. It's like, I am a 17-year-old kid and I have a broken leg. I'm about to go on TV, and the president of USA Gymnastics is only concerned about just the image and the marketing of all of this. And he said, take that boot off of her foot. And so that was just one instance where I felt like USA Gymnastics had, because I didn't, you know, live up to my potential and I hadn't gone on to do what everyone expected me to do, they began treating me differently and just kind of pushing me aside, and which was very different than how they had treated me before when I was the world champion and was doing really, really well. They kind of treated you like royalty if you were one of the top athletes. And if you weren't one of the top athletes, or if you were doing something they didn't like, which, you know, for me, it was wearing that boot because my leg was broken, then you were very obviously treated differently. So I'm sure I could sit here and rack my brain and think of more instances, but that's kind of just the attitude that USA Gymnastics had. If you were doing what they wanted to do, then you were treated well. And if you weren't, then you were kind of pushed aside.
Rita, Jordan, you two have both been through so much since public consciousness has become aware of what was going on within the USA Gymnastics program. And I just wondered, what has been helpful to you two in trying to make sense of it all and maybe to get your heads back right about, you know, what those years meant and what you wanted to remember of that time?
I guess for me, you know, the biggest thing that has helped me, well, a few things, but just all I've ever known in my life is just continuing to move forward past the bad things that have happened in my life. You know, things don't go my way. I just figure out a way to find meaning in it and keep moving forward. And so for me now, you know, speaking up against USA Gymnastics, against Michigan State, against some of these powerful institutions that protected USA Gymnastics and Larry Nassar, speaking up against them and really creating awareness around some of the abuse in gymnastics has, you know, helped me find meaning in what has happened to me. So I guess that's the first thing. And the second other big thing I would say is now coaching myself and being able to take what I've learned and what I've gone through and do right by the student athletes that come through my program and give them a good positive experience in the sport and help them reach their goals in a healthy way, where they feel seen, they feel heard, they feel understood. But at the same time, they're able to reach their potential in the sport. So being able to give back and create a different experience and contribute to the future of gymnastics in a positive way has really helped me cope with everything and find meaning in all the things that have happened to me.
Rita, how about you? This is a lot for a parent to digest.
Yeah. And I have to say, it's been very, very difficult for me to wrap my brain around everything that we've dealt with in the whole course of Jordan's career. And the only thing that kind of gets me through and makes me be able to spin this in some type of a positive light is the woman that Jordan's become, and the fact that she is doing what she's doing and has moved forward, and she's been resilient, and she's speaking out against all of these institutions. And that makes me so proud. And I'm thankful that she was resilient, because as a parent, it's very difficult to not ask yourself, you know, why didn't I catch this? Why didn't I say something? What was I thinking? Was I just too wrapped up in success and attention? How come I didn't do something about it? And so it's hard. I grapple with that constantly, but I'm very, very grateful that Jordan has, you know, is the woman that she is and has done very, very well despite everything that she's been through, and is going to be moving forward and helping so many people along the way.
Rita and Jordan Weber have been talking with us today. Ladies, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The new 30 for 30 series from ESPN titled Heavy Metals Inside the Karole Gymnastics Empire launched this week. If you'd like an even more in-depth look into how the tide turned for Larry Nassar's victims, you need to go listen to the Peabody-winning podcast for Michigan Radio and NPR. It's called Believed. Both of these are available now wherever you get your podcasts. After a break, a journalist from Michigan seeks advice on issues large and small.
Let me give someone something that they can listen to while they're peeing, you know, start and finish an episode, you know, by the time they're done going to the bathroom.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. When we're not busy putting together this daily news shows for you, most of us on the team are huge podcast listeners. And there's a relatively new production this year that has really got our attention. It's called The Best Advice Show. And we don't think the title oversells. Detroit radio producer Zach Rosen is asking people all around the city and from different spheres in his digital life about the stuff that works. From stockbrokers on taking the long view.
The more closely you watch markets, the more volatile they are.
To poet and critic Hanif Abdurraqib on keeping your work in perspective.
I did the best I could with what tools I had, and because I wrote that book, I was able to grow and write something else.
There's even advice from a six-year-old.
Sometimes if you do tell a lie, it's better to just tell the truth.
Zach Rosen, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. That's a nice intro.
How'd you hit on the idea of an advice show? You've done so many different kinds of work.
Yeah. Really, it was an iteration of a project that I started last year that didn't quite work. So what I was trying to do last year was to match young people who are interested in fill in the blank. Young people interested in acting or astronomy or whatever. And I was matching them with masters from that field. And I wanted to have this kind of mentor-mentee dynamic play out on tape. And I noticed it was really cool for both the mentor and the mentee, but the tape wasn't quite hot enough for me. And I was just noticing, though, that there were these little morsels inside those conversations that I thought were great. And so I thought, what if I could just kind of make some compressed piece of audio that, you know, would just contain like one discrete idea. And then I decided, oh, what if it contained one discrete piece of advice rather than these sprawling conversations that I really like to listen to? I just kind of wanted to sculpt something a little more minimal. And so I landed on this advice thing, because everyone has their own way of moving through the world and their way of just like making it through the day. And I just wanted to know, like, what is your specific way of getting through? And that's kind of where I landed.
One of the things that's so great about it is sometimes these take the form of pretty full-blown conversations, and sometimes they're just like 3 minutes long. What a beautiful thing to give yourself the freedom to go as long or as short as you need to in a world where podcasts are sometimes two guys talking nonstop for an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah, especially now that so many of us have lost our commutes, I was like, missing. I just don't have the time that I had earlier this year to listen to shows. And so another impetus was just, let me give someone something that they can listen to while they're peeing and, like, you know, start and finish an episode, you know, by the time they're done going to the bathroom. Maybe that's too graphic. Do you want me to give a different example of how someone can listen?
Are you kidding? That is definitely going in the interview. I hadn't tried it in that venue, but I confess I'm very curious to give it a shot. Zach, advice is kind of a funny thing. I mean, sometimes it's great, but most often when we get it, it's totally unsolicited and less than helpful. What kind of advice has worked out for you?
In my own life?
Yeah.
Like as a receiver of advice?
Yeah.
So, like, the way I'm thinking about the best advice isn't like someone, you know, telling me like this like perfect quote that's gonna set me free. It's just like these little specific things that people do, or that people suggest I might try that can improve my life. So, actually, there's one piece of advice that I got from a recent interview. It actually hasn't aired yet, but you know Gretchen Rubin, she's the host of Happier. It's like a big podcast that is all about finding happiness. But I asked her what's the piece of advice she dispenses the most, and she says, if there's something that you can do in less than a minute, just do it, and that's going to reduce so much clutter, like in your house. You know, like if there's just like some like box that's just sitting on your counter that needs to be thrown in the recycling bin, just do it, because it's just going to save you so much energy if you just kind of take care of it now.
That's so terrifying, though, because there's so many things that need to be done that take more than a minute. Will they ever get done if we keep doing the minute long things?
I think so, because like you can do the minute long things like between, you know, the longer term stuff, like when you're walking from your office to the kitchen, you can take care of that thing. You can throw that thing in the laundry instead of just leaving it for later. So I find like it's really helpful for not letting stuff pile up.
I'm sure you can't beat the sense of accomplishment that doing all those minute things brings you too.
It does feel good to reduce the clutter.
Do you have other favorites from the episodes that have dropped so far?
One that I think of so much is, it was one of the first episodes that I ran with a Detroit-based writer, Drew Philp, and he talked about this thing that he read about in Men's Health, and something that he practices as much as he can, where he will take an orange into the shower with him in the morning.
And, you know, get the shower like steaming hot, and the steam and the heat kind of like opens up your pores and your nostrils and your taste buds. It's just such a pure little moment of absolute sensual wonder and joy first thing in the morning, right when you get up and have to face the day.
And something about eating an orange while taking a morning shower is just this like zesty, vibrant way for him to awaken. And I just love that. Anyone can do it. And it's just like this little way to treat yourself that is cheap and easy and like super accessible. I love those types of things, like these little things that people do just to enrich their lives that like you don't need a lot of money for.
Do you know what my reaction was to that episode?
Tell me.
My thing is actually brushing my teeth in the shower. So
yes.
While Drew Philp is sparking joy, I'm just trying to maximize my to-do list for the morning.
I love that too. And you can be like a lot more blasé about like spitting, right? It's like, it doesn't matter. just spit it out and you can clean right off.
Totally.
With the shower spray.
There's one that I love with the musician Michael Franti, and it was offered in the spirit of keeping your relationship in shape, which I think that's something that a lot of people are trying to stay on top of during lockdown. And he talks about a question that he and his wife try to answer as they argue.
There's one phrase that we always go to, and it's, do you want to be right or do you want to be close? And that's the thing that helps us to, you know, sort of like ground down and get to home base. And sometimes we're able to do it in an hour. Sometimes it takes overnight. Sometimes it takes a couple of days. But really that base question is there, like, do you want to be right or do you want to be close? And so many arguments are just about proving that my opinion or what I did or what I said was okay. And that what she did or said wasn't okay. And once we can move past that and really get back to like what it is that we're making each other feel, then that empathy kicks in and I just go, man, I don't want to make you feel shitty. I want to make you feel good. Like, that's why I married you. That's what I signed up for. And that's what you signed up for. So let's get back to that place.
It was so commonplace, but so genius. Mm-hmm. You know, just a simple thing that you can do that's actually going to change the tone of what might be a really difficult interaction otherwise.
Yeah, and it can apply to, it doesn't just have to apply to marriages. It can be to friendships. It can be, you know, office politics. It can be international global politics. It's like interactions on Facebook. Yeah. This whole notion of just trying to be right is like, I don't know, I think it's a losing game.
Yeah. You have recently featured a week-long series of advice about listening and people talking about their tips for being a better listener.
For me, there is like a magical moment of this clicking over from passive hearing to active listening.
One of the things that inhibits people from listening is the momentum that comes inside us, the momentum from needing to be heard, right?
I'm not going to condemn a plant for being brown. You know what I'm saying? You know, it had the ability to be green. It had the ability to be healthy. So if I have the ability to nurture it, I'm going to nurture it.
Why was that on your mind?
Well, you know, I mean, you're a radio producer too. It's just, listening is our calling, us radio makers. And I've just always been fascinated with it, with the art of listening, the craft of it. And just like, I just find that, you know, sometimes, you know, back when we used to go to like parties, do you remember that?
Vaguely.
I kind of remember, yeah. Like you get caught up in a conversation with someone and they don't ask you anything about your life. And you're just like you're the only one asking questions. And like, I love asking questions, but I would just love to help people think about like, you know, why they might be taking up so much space in a conversation and, you know, how enriching it can be just to step back and let like someone else speak first. And so I had the idea for the listening week, because actually this Saturday, July 18th, is World Listening Day. So I thought, oh, this would be a cool kind of tag. But I didn't know the advice that I would be getting. All I knew was that I would be seeking out listening advice. And so what I subsequently got, all of it was, you know, stuff I had maybe thought about abstractly or maybe not at all until I spoke to my contributors.
They say that there are two kinds of people in the world. People who listen and people who are waiting to talk.
Mm.
Have you always been a listener?
I think so. Yeah, I have always been a listener. Partly because I have often been and continue to be pretty self-conscious about like whether or not I have anything valuable to say. I think I have some inferiority complex that, you know, goes back to having like some really smart friends and not maybe feeling that I was as smart as them. But yeah, I've always been a listener. My mom and her dad, so my mom and grandfather, were also big listeners and big listeners to strangers. And I just kind of noticed them growing up, you know, talking to cashiers and parking booth attendants and just like people in waiting rooms. And like one of my last memories of my grandpa is, him just starting a conversation with this guy at the DMV who was like in his 30s. This is when my grandpa was in his 90s. And I don't know. So I grew up seeing it. I guess that's who I am.
This concept, as you mentioned, it started before everything got so crazy in 2020. But as the crises have piled on, the pandemic, the Black Lives Matter movement, and just sort of the economic terror that so many people are going through with mass unemployment right now, how would you say the concept has evolved for what this series could or should do?
Yeah, especially in the wake of the killing of George Floyd, and noticing that myself and a lot of my white friends were searching for ways to process and be of use and just kind of understand our role in this country, I wanted to you know, have some more episodes geared toward like confronting whiteness, but also just like, you know, thinking about moving through the urgency of now without getting burnt out. And also, you know, just there's like the more mundane episodes about like hacks that contributors have found to be helpful for them as they work at home now, as people are working from home for the first time in a long time. And so those episodes are pretty fun. This is my third reference to a bathroom in this interview. I don't know what that says to me. But there's the episode from my colleague Ken Haddad, who talked about instead of having like that second or third cup of coffee in the middle of the day, he'll just take a shower because he's home, and that serves as, you know, a kind of new boost and a reset to the day. So like those types of episodes, I feel like now are particularly resonant because we all have this shared experience. Not all of us. My wife is working out of the house, but a lot of us have the same experience of working at home and just figuring out how to optimize this new experience.
Yeah. There are a couple of different podcasts that are in play right now that have tapped people of long experience to sort of speak to the current moment. And some of it hits, and some of it, I don't want to name any names because some of them are made by friends of mine. Some of them start to sound a little out of touch given the multiplicity of issues that everyone is dealing with right now. Is there anything that's helped you sort of keep the whole sound of the series grounded? Or what are you listening for to sort of really speak to people wherever they are right now? I guess what I'm saying is, like, how do you keep it relevant?
Well, I think that's the nice thing about the form of the show, because it is just this one little helpful, you know, I feel like any particular episode might not resonate with the listeners, but there's going to be some people that it does resonate with. So, you know, in the event that like there is an episode that doesn't feel quite relevant, like to a listener, it's okay because it's 2 minutes long and tomorrow they might find something that's like, you know, right down their alley. So, you know, I think I don't worry too much about that, but I think it's just more about me like following my curiosity and just like if I'm tickled or enchanted or challenged by someone's advice, I'll just kind of trust that the listeners will be as well.
Is there a particular kind of advice that you're excited about exploring in the weeks and months to come?
I just started to read this great essay about how to apologize, and I was thinking about doing like a week-long series about how to apologize, which is something that so many of us just don't know how to do. And similar to listening, it's just kind of this foundational skill that I think we need if we're going to evolve. And so, yeah, exploring the different textures and dimensions of an apology, I think that seems pretty exciting to me.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to hearing it. Zach Rosen is the producer of The Best Advice Show and a slew of other podcasts. You can pick it up wherever you get your podcasts today. Zach, thank you so much for talking to us, and thanks for the really great series.
Thank you so much, April. This has been really, really fun.
The That's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and Mercedes Mejia, along with our fabulous staff of interns, Leah Baldori, Catherine Newen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. The executive producer of Stateside is Laura Weber-Davis. The show is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.